Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later on today's show, we're going to meet a middle school choir teacher who struggled to keep her singers together and connected during the pandemic. That's on the way later in the show, but first, you may have heard tomorrow changes begin for Michigan's auto insurance market, changes that stand to affect every driver, and perhaps even more critically, people who were seriously injured in collisions, and their caregivers. Some care-providing companies are even saying that they're going to have to close up shop, leaving families in the lurch. Here to explain is Tom Judd. He's president of the Michigan Brain Injury Provider Council. Tom, welcome to Stateside.
I appreciate the opportunity to come on your show. Thanks so much.
The changes, when they were proposed, their authors say that they intended them to reform auto insurance in a way that would bring rates down and help customers. Can you remind us briefly what the changes are?
Sure, certainly. So in 2019, there was sweeping reform of our auto insurance system. And among those changes were personal injury protection choice. So no longer are drivers mandated to choose unlimited lifetime coverage. There's now different monetary cap levels. And that went into effect last July, 2020. Then there's other stipulations that look to bring down costs in the system. Utilization review, in which insurance companies now have a process to challenge, you know, medical treatment through a systematic process. You have fraud authority. So DIFS has, Department of Insurance and Financial Services has more teeth in terms of what they can do to investigate fraud in the system. Assigned claims cap. So, you know, that now has a threshold of $250,000. So there's all a host of aspects of that reform law that intended to bring down costs in the system and thus lead to premium reductions. Also in that bill was a medical fee schedule. And the base of that formula was to set rates for reimbursement for auto insurance claims at 200% of Medicare.
That sounds on the surface like it might be reasonable, but what do you see the consequences being for patients and caregivers?
Sure. So that 200% of Medicare that I spoke of only applies to services that have payable Medicare codes. Okay. If there's a service being provided that does not have a payable Medicare code, the default goes to a across-the-board 55% reimbursement cap for services that don't have that payable Medicare code. For hospitals, that's not a big deal. But for post-acute providers, those that provide short-term and long-term rehabilitation and care for catastrophically injured patients, that's most of our services. And we're talking about residential, specialized residential programs in a setting like an adult foster care home. We're talking about supported living in the community. And we're talking about in-home attendant care, where a person can maintain residence in their own home, but might require up to 24/7 supervision given their medical needs, cognitive challenges, behavioral needs. So all of these services that I just spoke of, not to mention a host of others such as vocational rehabilitation, driving rehabilitation, transportation, case management, all of these services as of tomorrow are going to be reimbursed no more than 55% of what they were being reimbursed in January 1, 2019.
So where do things stand right now, Wednesday, as we're having this conversation Wednesday afternoon in the legislature?
To this point, the legislature has passed on three viable long-term solutions. Three separate bills were introduced that gave different avenues to fix this very narrow part of the law, that 55% reimbursement cap, and put together a reasonable substitution. They have passed on all of those long-term solutions and are now debating a kind of, they're calling it a stopgap program, a budgeted program of $10 million where providers can seek assistance if they can demonstrate a systemic deficit because of the 55% reimbursement cap, and they can seek assistance through that program.
Right.
But there's a host of problems with that program as well. But right now that's in the Senate and they're most likely taking it up today. And so that's where we're at as of today.
Well, I gather you're saying that the stopgap money approved will not be enough to keep businesses afloat?
It won't be enough. It's not nearly enough of the kind of gap in funding we're talking about. The gap in funding we're talking about is about $350 million a year for those that are in the catastrophic claims fund, receiving funds through that. So the money's not enough. And the process is going to take an exorbitant amount of time. And providers aren't even going to be able to see any of this financial assistance until, you know, December into January because of the process that it takes to apply for this fund. So that's another 6 months of providers just, you know, working at a 45% reimbursement cut. And they're going to try and make payroll and sustain their operations for 6 months, and it's not sustainable. And so a lot of providers are not going to even make it to that point. So it's just, you know, I hate to say it, $10 million sounds like a lot to the public, I'm sure, but it is too little, and it's going to be too late.
Tom, what is the governor saying about all of this?
The governor throughout this process has said that she welcomes a narrow fix, but it's up to the legislature to get it to her desk. You know, she hasn't taken a strong stance in terms of really stressing to the legislature the dire need that is out there for this, unfortunately. And, you know, it sounds like from what she's made, you know, with some public comments, that she would be supportive of this stopgap bill, if you will.
Right.
Ignoring the pitfalls of the short-term ramifications and ignoring the fact that it does not lead to a long-term solution.
How do you explain why it is that the services weren't grandfathered for those who are already in the system? I mean, like you say, the amount of money that they're in disagreement about doesn't sound like that much. How do you explain why that didn't happen?
I'm not sure. I really don't have an answer for that. I mean, we know that there's $23 billion in the catastrophic fund sitting there. So I don't know why we're taking $10 million of taxpayer dollars to subsidize that fund. It just doesn't make much sense on a number of levels.
Are we talking about a principle of sort of trying to turn the system around and that maybe this would be the foundational piece of that?
That's what it seems like. I guess the next logical question is, what kind of system do these legislators want? Do they want a system where patients don't get quality specialized care? Do they want a system where 20-year-olds who are injured go to a nursing home and wait out the rest of their lives? Do they want a system where families can't provide care inside their homes? Do they want a system where people who could be living in their homes and relatively independent from government assistance are forced onto Medicaid and living in the nursing homes for the rest of their life, and instead of in their own home receiving care that they need?
Well, how would you define the terms then? What would you say that caregivers and advocates like yourself do want to see happen for changes with the law?
So we have focused our advocacy only on this very small, narrow part of the law. You know, we're not arguing against PIP choice, which has its own, you know, long-term ramifications of people not having lifetime care. We're not arguing against that. We're not advocating against that. We're advocating against a government mandated 55% reimbursement cap across the board, not considering individual companies and the margins they kind of work on. So what we've been advocating for is a long-term solution that really meets the intent of the law, which was 200% of Medicare, a fee schedule that brings consistency and reliability. Across the board, reimbursement cap does none of those things. So we have supported and proposed reasonable fee schedules that meet the intent of the law, provide a long-term solution, bring stability and consistency to the system, while still allowing providers to remain in business and provide the services that thousands of patients need across the state.
Do you know if any care providers have already closed down in anticipation of what it appears is about to happen?
Yep, absolutely. There's about 20 companies that I've been made aware of, and that's just me being made aware of them because of my position within our association. There might be companies across the state that I'm not aware of because maybe they're not part of our association, but you know, about 20 companies that have provided their patients with notices of discharge. Some of them are closing their doors, and some of them just can't simply provide services to patients with auto insurance funding because of the reimbursement level. And that's impacting up to 680 patients and impacting 1,500 jobs. And these jobs we're talking about are our healthcare heroes. And they're direct care workers who braved the pandemic, provided invaluable services, and now are being forced to find other work and lose their job because of this reimbursement cap. So that's happening now.
Yeah. Tom, the architecture of changes that got us to this situation is a little bit complicated. And I know that your members are caregivers. They're not insurance providers. But I just want to note that most of Michigan's drivers are still choosing the unlimited coverage that's the default option under the new rules. And a lot of people have just been looking at the bottom line on their bills, and they've been going with the cheapest possible option. And the argument from the industry is that what we've got here is just not a long-term viable solution. Where's the middle ground here?
There really is no middle ground. Either we have that system or we don't. This 55% reimbursement cap makes those lifetime benefits much less valuable and much less meaningful, because there's going to be significantly less options for care. They couldn't legislate out the lifetime care option because we have seen time and time again that people want that benefit. And we're going to continue to see it as people continue to choose that benefit. So instead of legislating it out, they've created a system in which they have made that lifetime benefit pretty much irrelevant, because the long-term care for catastrophically injured patients simply isn't going to be there.
Tom Judd is president of the Michigan Brain Injury Provider Council. Tom, thank you for talking with us.
I appreciate the opportunity.
This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We've talked in months past about how some of Michigan's Black families took stock of the pandemic moment and decided to try homeschooling their children. A recent article in the New Yorker magazine wrote about several Michiganders who had this experience. It also talked about the optics of the largely white, largely evangelical homeschool movement, and whether Black children and families might find financial support and some shared goals within it. With us today are Bernita Bradley, an advocate, author, and social entrepreneur. She's the Midwest Regional Delegate to the National Parents Union. She's a founder of Engage Detroit Homeschooling Network and also operates The Village, a company that does recruitment work. Also with us today is Keisha Gray, educator and advocate. She's a founding director of Our Children Count, which provides coaching and advocacy for parents. She's also the host of Openly Gray with Keisha Gray, a show that streams and podcasts on the Motor City Woman Radio Network. Both of them have homeschooled their kids. Keisha, Bernita, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you.
Bernita, the last time we talked to you, you laid out your interest in homeschooling and sort of how it got started with your daughter, Victoria, asking you to do it. But I don't think we talked in much detail about what Victoria had been through. Can you tell us about some of the experiences she had? That, you know, what leads a child to say, can I school from home?
Yeah, so one, bullying issues had happened extreme at some level in her school. So my daughter's pre-K education was like what any parent would want to dream of. Just like she was learning, she really was, up to maybe about second grade. And she started having these repeat occurrences of either bullying or having teachers who really just didn't get her, right? And my daughter, being a lover of education, like literally, genuinely loves teachers, but her experience began to be tainted by teachers who had these different perceptions of them as students. So my daughter found herself in the assistant principal's office at third grade, actually reporting a teacher. Ironically to me, I'm thinking the principal's calling me, telling me my daughter's done something. Or when I walked in the building, you know, she wanted to talk to me. And I'm looking at my daughter like, what have you done? Like, what is this about? Right? Mm-hmm. This is a first. But it was my daughter reporting a teacher who was calling the students her East Side ghetto babies. Mind you, this is a Black teacher who we sometimes think would be more compassionate to children. But what my daughter has experienced through most of her life is not just white, but Black issues in schools. And it became too much for her in fifth grade. myself, I was just like, you know, I don't think I have the wherewith to do it. Like, I really don't see homeschooling the way I would want to homeschool. And I'm working, I'm doing all these other things. So let's just fight for you to get what you need at school. And that's the mode that I was working from for a while until the pandemic happened. And my daughter told me she was going to drop out of school if school was the same way it was from March to May, when she only had interactions with one teacher at her school that she was enrolled in, and that was the dance teacher. She struggled, and teachers were constantly telling them, I've emailed you this, I've uploaded this into this program, go on, you should know how to do it. This is where we left off at, and if you need me, see me at this 1 hour window that I have a week, which is called my prep time. Mm. I was like, yeah, no, this is not right. Knowing Keisha, and seeing her remarkable work with her children, I was like, okay, Keisha, what do I do?
Yeah. Well, Keisha, I know that you had some investment in more traditional education. You used to work at a charter school. Can you tell us the story of what led you into homeschooling?
Well, I guess it goes way back. I am the child of two educators, and my grandparents before were educators and headmasters. So I yield from the Caribbean, right? And my parents, particularly my mother, always had a dream to educate us on the road. She wanted to buy an RV, have us educated in it. That was her dream. But even when you have a dream or a vision like that, the pressure of understanding that public education or what we've always done is what we should be doing is really, and life is why we choose these things. So I had that dream planted in me to homeschool, but I just didn't do it right away. So my kids attended a charter school in Detroit. I also taught at the charter school. And when I left that charter school system, I was the director of parent and community engagement. In my work, I really saw some of what Bernita describes, but I also realized that parents had visions and dreams for their children that weren't rooted in reacting to poor schools. They just wanted to make choices that were in their children's best interest. And I wanted to be a conduit for that change. So I knew that my work had to surround supporting parents and helping them understand the power that they have to choose to educate their own children.
Mm-hmm. Keisha, we've talked to Bernita about how much more interest she saw from people this year, people who said, how are you doing what you're doing? How do you describe, Keisha, what happened this year? I mean, is this a case of a dam breaking and all this pent up, you know, unmet need in education, finding a funnel and finding a place to, you know, to vent into homeschooling? Or how do you describe what you see?
Well, absolutely. I think that Black families always understood that schools as a system were not necessarily designed to serve our whole Black child, right? So you would find schools that were penalizing Black children, expelling children. So we had these conversations before there was a pandemic. When the pandemic happened and schools closed and parents were at home, it wasn't homeschooling, it was schooling at home, because that's what happened. For many parents, they saw some of their children start to really thrive by not being in environments that were oppressive to them, right? So many of those parents were like, hey, if my child is thriving like this, I might want to continue this journey. And that's where you saw the wellspring. Parents saying that, like, if my work isn't an issue and I don't have to go to work and I can get support through programs like Engage Detroit, maybe I can do this. And so our work has been to reassure parents that, yes, you can do it.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, I'm talking today with Keisha Gray, educator, podcaster, and founding director of Our Children Count. Also with us is Bernita Bradley, an advocate, an author, and Midwest Regional Delegate to the National Parents Union. You know, one of the things that I didn't realize and that was informative about the New Yorker article is some of the roots of America's homeschooling movement and just how much early energy and early focus came out of the evangelical white Christian movement. And actually, I was talking to a friend who a white friend who was homeschooled recently who told me that, you know, her parents really didn't tell her about the civil rights movement or the Holocaust, and that the history book had a picture of Jesus on the cover. Looking at the materials and textbooks and curriculum out there when you first got into this, I wanted to ask, well, Brenita, but really both of you, did you feel like you were entering a space where you had what you needed to tell your kids what you really wanted them to know?
So let me first start by saying homeschooling for Black families didn't start from evangelical churches. Mm-hmm. That movement whatsoever. Black families have been forced to homeschool their children since slavery time, right? Like Black families have always taken it upon themselves to take their own rituals and their own rites and say, I am going to educate my children. The systems don't do that well for our children. So it has nothing to do with this savior complex of we're mimicking something white people have done. Never. Right. The other aspect of it is that Black people don't need this tool or framework from a white person to understand how to educate our children. We actually disconnect from that same analogy to make sure our children have their own roots, their own culture, their own history actually at hand whenever they need it. And that's partially what we did through Engage Detroit. We pursued our history. We even went as far as to do DNA tests so that our children can use history to research their own family, right? And when we tell the story of Black homeschoolers homeschooling based on a white perception, we take the power from what Black people are actually doing. This is like the resistance. This is us saying, if you won't reinvent and reimagine education with all the millions and billions of dollars that go through this system that says that you're supposed to be educating our children, we'll do it ourselves. And we disconnect.
Yeah. By whatever means are available.
By whatever means, right? And I shouldn't say whatever means, because I know the New Yorker article insinuated that we were like this prop for the Koch brothers, to be quite frank, and that we were this group that was funded intentionally to take children out of public schools, when what the New Yorker never explained, that over 70% of our children were charter school students, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. These were families who were tired of systems failing their children, and we decided less help, you know, but there's not this one framework where we were just like some entity that the Koch brothers or any organization said, if you do this for us, we will give you money. No. And also there was funds of politicians who came to us and asked us to take. I denied specifically because I knew they had an agenda. Mm-hmm. And most of the funding that we received, I interviewed the people when they came to interview me, because I want to know what is behind your motive and what is behind. And that's anybody. That is anybody. Like that article, I hurt my families. And I felt like I let my families down because I invited them in. I vetted them. And I felt like you twisted this story to make us these unintellectual, guided by funding, puppets on a string to actually make homeschooling look good when parents were tapping out.
Well, let's, Keisha Gray, what about that? What do you think this year has made possible for the many iterations of what homeschooling can look like for Black families?
Well, I think it's really important to always think about why we're educating our kids the way we are. Any parent that I coach, I ask them to have a vision, what their vision is for their child. And we talk about that, right? And I think in this country, we also have to ask ourselves, why are bigger entities so invested in educating Black children? And when I sit with that and I think about a country who had slave codes, who's one of the first slave codes that they had in this country was that Black folks should not be able to read or write. Those same systems cannot then be committed to being so invested in the well-being of her children, right? So I start there. I think that for parents, it's like the story of the three little pigs. I'm going to use that analogy. When schools shut down, a lot of parents didn't know what they were doing.
Yeah.
They were building a house out of twigs. Like, hey, let's pull this together.
That's exactly what it felt like. Yeah.
Right. That's when Bernita and I started talking, like, hey, what are we going to do for parents? Let's start putting this house of twigs together so that we can at least have a place for our kids. And sometimes when you looked early in the early stages of the pandemic, that might have meant sitting on your couch. You might not even have had a laptop. Pardon me. You might have had a cell phone, right? Twigs. Mm-hmm. The next stage was But the next stage was getting to a more stable environment, which is where Engage Detroit came in. Hey, let's get desks, or let's get, let's put some things in place where we know we're going to be here for a second. Let's create a stable environment. That was the coaching for parents. How might that look? Do you have a space where your child feels comfortable learning? Let's figure out what kind of things your child likes to learn. Let's provide support for you. As the world starts to open up again, there are some people who will go back to the brick and mortar that they knew. But there will be a group of parents, a large proportion of Black families who will start to build their own brick house. You know, and that's the story of the three little pigs. And it is building a brick house where you decide, I have a vision for my child, and we are on this path to choosing our educational journey together. And I think that's so powerful.
What might that homeschool house of bricks look like? Can you give us some examples?
Absolutely. So I know of the parents that I coach, when kids got home, when you're in school and your agenda is given to you by teachers, you may not be passionate about the things you're learning because you really don't have, you're not empowered in schools to select what you want to learn. That is given to you. When we talk about homeschooling, like Bernita said, is sort of the umbrella loose term that we use for all other types of schooling. Homeschooling could be road schooling. I'm on the road in my RV. It could be unschooling. I do math, or wherever I am, life is the school. It can be all these things. So sitting down and really supporting parents and helping their kids be a bigger part of that conversation. So when I have two children, my two youngest, they were homeschooled. And at first it was really hard for them to find their legs, but I kept asking the question, what is it you're passionate about? What brings you joy? What are the things that you love learning? And it was from their leadership that I supported them in getting to what they needed. I don't know if the New Yorker article really presented that notion of resistance and choice in a way that really paints the picture that our kids have agency over their educational choice. It's their journey. Our job as parent coaches, and for me as a parent, is to really support the transitions that they'll make.
Yeah. You know, Bernita pointed out that we're talking about a cohort of parents who are definitely engaged and who are concerned about their children's education. What challenges do you see ahead for them as they're out there with their kids, you know, building the house of bricks them on their own? And what do you think that they will need to be successful?
I think part of it would be resources.
And feel free to chime in, Bernita.
Yeah. So resources, one, right? The community support to acknowledge that partnerships are key, right? Like in our white communities, like the Niles Community School District, they have partnerships that they built with the YMCA, their local colleges, all these type of things. Like when you see a homeschool student come through other cities, they're not questioned. Like, what do you mean homeschooling? Like, what do you do at home? Like, these children are let into programs just like normal public school or whatever students, right? But in the city of Detroit, what we noticed in creating the partnerships that we created over the last year is that a lot of people questioned that. Like, you mean you're virtual schooling? No, I'm homeschooling. What type of curriculum are you? How are you proving what you're doing? Like, they start doing this thing of judging our choices, right? And choice should never be judged. So that's been the biggest challenge to me. Not so much as how the families can handle it, but how community is perceiving homeschooling.
Bernita Bradley, she is an author and an advocate and the founder of Engage Detroit Homeschooling Network. We've also been talking with Keisha Gray, founding director of Our Children Count and host of Openly Gray with Keisha Gray. Ladies, thank you so much for talking with us today. We appreciate your time very much.
We appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. You want to talk about someone who's put a mark on the city of Detroit? Think about places like the Detroit versus Everybody mural on Russell Street, the Brush Street Viaduct mural, LGBT Detroit, Brilliant Detroit on Hazelwood. These are some of the many spots all across town where you can find murals by Backpack Durden. And it's not just murals, by the way, Backpack calls a specialty. They've been known to style hair, to ink tattoos, to illustrate. Master of all, Backpack Durden is one of those people whose work speaks for itself and speaks in many languages. When you meet them, you'll see that there's so much more to their story. They join us now from their home in Detroit. Backpack Durden, welcome to Stateside.
Hello.
What do you remember about being a young artist? Could you just take us back and tell us about some first favorite things to create?
Favorite things. I used to just like make stuff really tiny and then sell it back to my parents. Like I used to make these pillows made out of construction paper stapled together, and then I would draw and write their favorite things on it and stuff it with tissue and then sell it to them. And they paid for it, so that was appreciated.
You know, it's not every artist that can get that successful business plan, especially right. Not from the early days. That's awesome. What did they like? Did they open them up then, or did they just know that you had stuffed them with goodness?
I had to sell them on it. I had to sell them on the idea of what it was, and that you just had to let it be because it was art. You know,
parents are the best.
Parents are awesome. But other than that, like, I used to draw all the time and draw really small, and then everything tiny would make something bigger, and it didn't make sense until it was completely done.
Were you in a place where there were a lot of other creatives around you? Did you know a lot of artists growing up?
I didn't know people to be artists. I knew people to be people, I guess, and they had creative pursuits. My grandmother was a seamstress and also a world traveler, and she would collect a bunch of art and statues and pretty much everything from all over the world. So I was surrounded by that and surrounded by everything she made and made us wear. And my mom was an illustrator and a painter, but went toward video production and then ended up not doing most of that. And my brother was an illustrator as well.
Mm. Will you tell me about some of the things that your grandma, as you put it, made you wear? That sounds very intriguing.
Oh, the first outfit I can think of is from Easter, and me and my sister had matching outfits, and this like gold foil looking coat with a matching hat, and it's got like this quilted lining look to it, and it was hot. I remember it was hot, and I had to wear like patent leather shoes. It was that was my childhood, I think.
First of all, I really need that for the cold winter. I don't understand why this was an Easter outfit. This clearly should have been Christmas finery. But also, it sounds like you come from a line of explosively creative people. That's not something everybody's gram would stitch up for them. I love it.
Right.
There's an interesting story, I feel, for every muralist, as we find out how the imagination grew into larger and larger spaces. Could you talk a little bit about how your practice moved from, you know, painting and forms of illustration into mural art?
Well, this is a fun and story. People tell me that I should paint because I was always drawing really, really small detail. But no one told me why I should paint. And it wasn't until I would say I started working with Sydney James, assisting her on murals and just learning all of her techniques and how she scales up her illustrations and her paintings. And then I accidentally started painting with oils via
accidentally.
My partner at the time was an oil painter, and she said that I could use the paints if I wanted to. And I was like, I don't want to paint. And then I was bored enough one day, and I did it, and it made sense. So, but they both started at the same time, painting studio and painting mural. It was like, I would say a year or two difference between when I started painting for myself and painting for other people. And then a year after I started oil painting, or within the same year, I started painting my own murals.
What do you like about that, having that kind of a space to work on?
It's intimidating at first, and then I think it's a chance to make a concept larger and reach more people, and then it turns into fun instead of scary. So I like that more than anything.
Nice. Backpack, you do a fair number of self-portraits. Some of them are solo. I am really, really captivated by one that I think is a more recent work where you've sort of inserted yourself across a couple of geometric planes. The portrait's called Not This Again. Could you tell us a little bit about that one?
I was making a shift from painting other people to painting myself more. And I don't actually really like painting myself, honestly, but I'm the narrative that I know the best and the most, and that I feel I have the privilege to tell the story of. And in this instance, it was basically a mental health crisis and falling into depression constantly, like the cyclical nature of falling into depression. So that one was that one.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the physical posture in that one?
Okay. I'm falling through the triangle because it's a quick fall into depression and a long climb out of it. So sometimes you just get blindsided, and that's that whole motion is you get blindsided and you fall into it. And you're going from a spectrum of colors into a monochromatic black and white space. And yeah, there's a shift.
You've also worked to highlight some issues in neurodiversity and mental health. That self-portrait, Not This Again, is a perfect example. You know, sort of keeping that opening that conversation and keeping it open. And it's something that the culture often, it feels like our culture would often like to sideline or just treat as a niche issue.
Right.
Why is this something that's been important for you to take on?
It's important because I can't talk about it. It's so hard to talk about, especially because everyone's experience is different. So through therapy nowadays, I'm learning to understand that the visual medium is my language, and that's how I can explain to other people better than my words can, because they fail me oftentimes. So I would try and use an analogy to explain how I'm feeling, and it wasn't being understood, and so I made it into a visual. Like the one with the spinning top, that one is a direct reflection of, I think, going into an anxiety attack. Now I've got some distance from it.
We should mention that the painting with the spinning top is called Control. People can see it at Backpack's website. You also have done a portrait of yourself with your partner, Syra Dardis. It's beautiful and joyful.
Thank you.
What does it mean to you to portray your own self and your public work in these ways?
I often try to block my face, and others, unless it's absolutely necessary to have someone's face in it. But in our instance for this mural, Constellation in Winter, it's on the LGBT Center, which was like, I didn't think that I would be able to paint on something that was so reflective of my identity so soon, I guess. And I was like, well, I think we should just like show love in the most basic form, in a non-gendered way, like as a photograph even. And it worked out, I think.
Can I take a sec to describe it?
Yeah.
You've chosen to portray you and Syra as, I mean, what we really see is just your hands clasping, and you're in a posture that's, you know, you're sitting very close together. It's just very intimate and very everyday, you know, just kind of something that you might see, you know, any couple do. And yet it's so relaxed and so kind of not remarkable in that way, which is, it's kind of what makes it wonderful for me.
I agree. Not remarkable is beautiful.
If you're just joining us today, I'm talking with Backpack Durden, muralist, illustrator. I don't know what to say. Stylist of the body? I mean, your canvases are so many and so varied. But working in Detroit, all over Detroit and its people. You know, for folks who didn't catch the introduction, and I was using your pronouns, you identify as trans. In a place and a time where trans visibility is pretty minimal, even today, and even in some art spaces. I wanted to ask if there are some ways in which your creative practice has included yourself.
Well, for a long time, I was hiding myself. And it honestly didn't do me any service, or it did the art a disservice as well. So leaning into my own narrative as a trans person and a multi-dimensional, intersectional human being who experiences the world in this certain way, I felt like it was important to be visible but safe, to speak to the things from my perspective and share them in a way that I felt was safe for me. And I feel like doing that, I'm being visible for other people down the line, like people have for me in different ways. So,
is there anything you can tell us about the ways that you do that, that you ensure your own safety?
This is hard. Sometimes I don't put where I am when I'm painting a mural unless I can be off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's in a highly populated area, I'll say where I'm at or make sure that there's people checking in on me. And then oftentimes I get misgendered and threatened and stuff, and I just roll with it because it's not the place to educate people if it's on a level of conflict. So just gotta like watch behind me while I'm painting, I guess.
Yeah. Eyes open. 360 degrees, 24/7.
Head on a swivel.
Right. Was it frightening to start thinking about using your art to talk about those issues and also to be more open? Has that process become any easier over time?
I was going to say no, but I think so. I think it's become easier because once I went up three steps, there was someone there to hold my hand to the next three steps, and then someone else to pat my back on the next three steps. And the language and the idea and the understanding has been lifted, and like expanding, and I'm even understanding myself more, and I'm hopefully helping other people to understand themselves more, and hopefully me too. And it's like a snowball effect. You're just going to keep picking up more snow and keep rolling.
I think we don't talk about mental health enough. I especially think we don't talk about it for people who do creative work and who, you know, they do the work they love. So everybody assumes that, you know, they should be doing great. In your work with other artists, how do you see mental health coming up?
It comes up in so many ways, but when it comes to the work itself, it isn't always, it's not on the surface of what it is. But if you go a few layers lower, you understand that this person is struggling and trying to explain that in this way where they feel safe. But people see this beautiful thing and they want to have it at a price that they need to have it. They don't care who made it. Like, it's sometimes it ends up like that, but sometimes it's on the back end of surrounding yourself with the right community and then them understanding it and uplifting your work and working through the things that you need to work through.
Yeah. Detroit's creative profile has become so high in recent years. What does being an artist in Detroit mean to you right now?
Oh boy. Well, at this juncture, it means build the right community. Because there in the past, everything has been predicated on ego, I think. And now we're getting in right relation with longevity and sustainability. And I think it just took a lot of time to realize that we shouldn't be fighting each other. We should be building everyone up. So.
You worked on starting something called the Starving Artist Movement. Could you explain what it's about and what you're up to these days with it?
Starving Artist is my business, my LLC, where the checks get made to. And under that, we started Paper Street. So with Starving Artist, I do a lot of production work in terms of around art, which is everything. And then I also do a lot of documentation for folks and for myself. And the idea is to uplift artists where they're at, including myself, including my partner, including my friends, and get us to where we need to be without the necessity of elite structures that have been placed upon us. So
would it be right to describe it as a design and creative services operation?
See, that's why I need people like you around.
Right.
You're like, right. Bring it down.
Yeah. Oh. Backpack, Detroit's creative scene has gotten just this incredible boost of national and global attention. And there are creators coming to Detroit these days from all over the place. And there's plenty of middle-class white people coming. But there are also people of color coming to Detroit who want to take part in the community and who want to take part in the energy. Do you think at all about the balance? I mean, it's great to have a lot of resources and a lot of money pouring into the city.
Right.
But it has at times led to people who have been doing things here the hard way of their whole lives getting left out. How do you think about that balance?
There's a way to find a balance, but oftentimes people want to move too fast and go the route that they know to work instead of considering the folks that like are from here that do get left behind. I think the balance comes down to humility and listening. Yeah. Humanity?
Yeah.
Empathy? Yeah. There's like, I could go on about like how not having the education that's been you know, held over our heads has held me back. But at the same time, I'm like, I don't care. I'm gonna keep making art. I'm gonna keep being a good person. I'm gonna keep being like building community with folks that want to build community and be in right relation to the things that are shaking out in the world. And if you miss it, then that's your fault, as opposed to beating myself up about being looked over all the time.
That actually brings me around to something that I wanted to ask you about. You know, you mentioned that you've been drawing forever.
Yeah.
When I look at your murals, I just see a mastery of light and image that really is unique. Sydney James has that too. You know, I see that in her yeah. work. But you have such a painterly grasp on that. Is there anything that you think really was formative to you in developing that visual style, especially when you're painting people?
Oh, cinema. I am inspired by cinema and the fact that you can capture so much without saying a lot and with saying almost too much. But like the cross section between film and cinema and I would say Baroque art. And then that fits within a larger bubble of identity and telling that story. So I want to make sure that the light is telling a story, the subjects are telling a story, the color is telling a story. Like everything is considered whenever I make things.
Backpack, I know you're working on a mural this summer. Is it anything that you can tell us about?
I'm currently working on a mural, and it's in conjunction with Black Lives Matter Detroit. And then there's some other murals that I can't talk about. And I also have a show later in the year with Playground Detroit.
Well, sign me up. I cannot wait. And Backpack, it is such a pleasure talking to you. We kind of want to just know about everything you're working on all the time. So please do keep in touch. We'd love to have you back sometime.
Of course.
Backpack Durden, see their work all over Detroit. Like, literally, all over Detroit. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. A couple of times this summer, I've been driving past churches in my neighborhood and seeing choir members out on the church lawn singing together in practice. The act of singing with others in public was one of the first things we lost when the pandemic struck. And teachers of singing have had to be especially creative. However, some choir teachers in schools simply don't have the resources to make something like practice feasible. So we're going to talk today about the challenges that arts educators face this year and how they're preparing for the next school year without some of the performing arts. Carrie Sophia Dean is choir director at Ypsilanti Community Middle School. Carrie, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Your school decided not to offer choir as an elective for this coming school year. Can you talk about why and how that decision was made?
Well, they decided that all elective classes would be online virtually, even though they offered a two-day face-to-face hybrid program. They were keeping all the elective teachers online. And we already have a band teacher who was teaching a music class. And so they had asked me to teach a reading class instead.
Wow. That had to be tough.
It was at the end of March when we were virtual. I was still teaching choir online. And we were also in the middle of our musical, Hairspray. And so we were trying to keep up some rehearsals for Hairspray virtually. And they were not as into it as I was. And I realized that the kids who want to sing in choir are those social kids who want to be with everybody and want to feel that excitement together.
Right.
And so we did some recordings. We did a few things together, but my main singers had kind of lost interest. And I wasn't sure if I could do that in the fall with middle school kids. The high school choir did it and it was great, but the middle school kids weren't into singing by themselves and recording it, and then me putting it all together.
Oh, man, that age.
Yeah.
Was there a moment when the truth of all this kind of came home to you?
Yes, because we had postponed our musical. And we were still thinking, like, maybe we could do it next year. Maybe we could do it in the summer. Maybe we could have, like, a camp and perform it outside. And then the MTI company contacted me, and we had to make that decision because all of our leads have moved on to high school. And so we decided to cancel it. And then that was it. It was sad.
Yeah.
It was sad.
What? How did the kids react when they heard the news?
Oh, the kids in the musical were the most upset. I think because it was gradual, like, you know, it was virtual, but then we didn't know, and they were always changing, and I didn't really have contact with all of my kids, and so I would email them and check in with them. We have a Facebook page for the musical, you know. I would check in then. They were upset. I know they were upset.
What do you think it's going to be like trying to get the kids into the frame of mind that you'd like to have them in to do a musical this year?
It's going to be like starting over. And in some ways, that scares me because I worked so hard to get this group of kids who knew what choir was. They were choir kids. They wanted to sing in tune. They could hear when they weren't singing the right notes. And then to have to start over, that will be hard. We also were doing a musical, and it was our fourth musical. And so we had students who had been in musicals, and they were so experienced of what it meant and what it was. And so now we won't have those kids in the school. It is a challenge just because I get a lot of kids and they don't even know what choir is.
Yeah. Being in a play is just, it's a commitment too. It's more than just being able to sing and remembering the lines. I mean, it's just this whole social and work experience that a lot of kids are just learning for the first time.
Yes. And like the attendance is important. And so we'd set up all these rules about you can't miss more than this. And it was just really hard. You know, a lot of our kids don't have rides, and of course they don't drive. And so trying to get the transportation set up and the work schedule set up with parents, and that was really hard at the beginning. I even had a student who we got to the show and his mom said, oh, he can't make the Saturday show because he has soccer. And I'm like, no, it's a show. He has a part. Nobody can fill his spot. But by the time we got to this one, they were just so committed and they wanted longer rehearsals and they wanted more rehearsals. And, you know, they would practice on their own in the lunchroom. So that wasn't a problem.
So now that last school year is over, you know, some teachers expressed that they were just exhausted. I mean, there was a lot of crazy stuff. Some teachers were teaching all in person. Some had, you know, things that they had to do differently because of that. There were some people who were trying to teach remotely and in person at the same time. There were some people who just had to completely reconfigure what they were trying to do with their kids over the year. And then there were some who said it was okay, you know, that they didn't mind that much. Where do you stand? How would you say your year went?
Personally, I loved my year because I did get to try to teach different things. I taught a reading class and I'm certified to teach language arts. And so I love that. And then I got switched to a self-contained special education room, which was a very new experience. And I love that. I love a challenge. But I did miss choir and I hated the sitting. So for me, because as a choir and drama teacher, I was always on my feet. I look at students to get that feedback and assess, you know, I assess students by hearing them and by watching them and seeing expressions on their face. And so trying to teach when you don't even see kids, that was that was terrible for me. I don't want to do that again.
It sounds like you felt the same as some of the kids.
Yes. And so it was like, I really wanted to replace choir and I really wanted to keep that music going. And I do appreciate all the people that made that happen. But for me, it wasn't a replacement. It didn't work for me. So I'm so looking forward to next year. And even this summer, I'm teaching a drama summer school class in July. And I'm really excited about that.
Amazing. Well, I think that is kind of something that people are pinning their hopes on, is that the return to school this fall is going to look a lot more normal. At the same time, given vaccination rates in the state, I think a lot of people are just kind of watching and waiting to see what happens. Do you worry at all that choir might be sparse next year? I mean, or for that matter, like, do you have the space to spread kids out a little bit?
No, I don't have the space. Just because we move schools and it is smaller. I'm thinking that maybe my class sizes will just have to be a little bit smaller so we can space out. And, you know, I'm trying to look at, you know, I wasn't in that choir teacher world this year. And so I'm trying to get back into that just to get suggestions from other choir teachers to see what they're doing. I know there's some air purifiers that you can get. It'll be another challenge for me, just singing with mask. I'm not sure what will happen, but I'm ready for that challenge as right. long as we're together.
Carrie, have you yourself been able to stay healthy this year?
I tried. I was very careful and I followed all the rules, and I did get COVID at the end of October. And the good thing was that I had it when my school was on break and online. And so I didn't have to miss a lot of school. I kept teaching. I don't know how, but I don't remember, like, I kind of had the long hauler COVID. Wow. And so I do have like just some things that I don't remember around that time when I really didn't feel good. But we did go back to school later in the spring, and that helped me to kind of get my strength up and recover.
I know that some respiratory therapists have been telling long haulers to sing as much as they can to build up their wind. Did singing help you get your health back?
It did. I made myself sing, and I could definitely tell, you know, with my breathing from my diaphragm that I need to get that strength back up. But music was, you know, just listening to music and listening to music that I can sing with really did help me get through that.
Other than standing up, what do you miss the most about teaching choir?
Seeing the joy in my students' faces, that is always my goal. As a choir teacher, it's never been that I have the best choir that sings in tune. And, you know, in Ypsilanti, there's just not a lot of experienced singers coming from elementary, and that doesn't matter. I just love to hear kids sing. I love to hear them put their voices together and to create harmony for the first time, and just being with them and spending time with them. You know, with choir, I really try to get that sense of belonging into our school community. And I feel that's the most important part of my program. And I miss that.
I know you do a lot of different kinds of conducting, from, you know, classroom choir to the musicals and stuff. But are there any choral works or plays or songs that have been on your mind for this moment that you might try to snap on the kids this year?
Oh, that is a good question. I just started, you know, listening to songs and trying to plan to get some. You know, I am all about social justice, and I just saw something on Netflix. It's about pop music. And one of the episodes is about the power of a song. And so I think I want to focus on some social justice music and choir songs for them. There was one that the women sang at the Women's March called, I think, Quiet, like I Can't Be Quiet, something like that, but definitely some social justice songs.
Carrie Sophia Dean is a choir director at Ypsilanti Community Middle School. Carrie, thank you so much for talking to us, and good luck this summer and fall.
Thank you.
A dispute over whether a road and beach in Leland Township is public has heated up again recently after county and local officials rejected a proposal from landowners. Officials are now regrouping as they try to keep the area available to all. IPR's Taylor Wisner has the story for us.
For years, Leland residents have accessed Lake Michigan by a sandy road off Reynolds Street. It led to an area known as South Beach and nicknamed the Christmas Tree Beach by locals, says Township Supervisor Susan Ock.
The people who use that beach walk to the beach from their homes. Kids ride their bikes there. It was, for generations, the main beach that you went to.
But in the last few years, the homeowners on the north and south ends of the road have sued the township, saying the land is theirs.
I don't know why the people on either side suddenly decided that it wasn't a public beach and that they owned that piece of property on either side. It's not as if they were paying taxes on it all this time.
The homeowners claim that Reynolds Street does not go all the way to Lake Michigan. They say that a road that is no longer there intersects with Reynolds Street, causing it to end before the beach. Ock says the true history of the road is confusing.
Some plat maps show Reynolds Street going all the way to the water, some don't.
She says the township has aerial photos showing it was used as a public road leading all the way to the beach. Ock also says the state of Michigan has recognized it as a public beach since the 90s. The homeowner's lawsuit against the township entered mediation in October last year. The parties agreed to settle, and the public would keep its access. But the homeowners had some conditions. Among the demands, they asked to put up a 6 or 9 foot fence leading to the beach, and that sand deposits could only be put on the beach with their permission. But the community was adamantly opposed. More than 100 people showed up at the township's public meeting earlier this month, with the vast majority saying the agreement should not move forward. Township officials wanted the settlement done and were concerned about a potentially expensive legal battle. But they agreed with residents' concerns and voted 3-2 against signing. The Road Commission followed suit and voted unanimously to reject the agreement. Longtime Leland resident Bob Schleter is representing locals' interests in the dispute. He helped start the township's Parks and Recreation Department back in the 90s. He says it's been sad seeing the culture around sharing the beaches change since he was a kid growing up here.
Whether you accessed it on a 60-foot road end or down through, you know, between two homes when the owner was saying hi to you as you were walking by, there was never a question that it was public use.
But Schleter admits the popularity of the peninsula has boomed in recent years.
There is nothing similar to the people activity now as it was when I was growing up or even 20 years ago, once we got discovered.
It's not just tourists who can cause issues. He knows from his Parks and Rec days that local partying leads to litter and nuisance complaints.
You know, we had a system where we followed up on complaints and we got down there. It wasn't perfect. It's never perfect. You know, you have kids that have beer parties. You have kids that start fires.
Schleter suspects increasing complaints led to the lawsuit. The landowners didn't return my calls for comment. And one of the lawyers representing them says because the case is still in negotiations, it wouldn't be appropriate for him to comment. With the current settlement out, though, the future of the beach remains uncertain.
Well, we've taken a time out right now.
The township plans to meet again with the Road Commission to hack out a new agreement. This time, Ock hopes to include input from a community advisory group as well. But she doesn't trust it will be resolved easily. She says after the settlement was initially agreed to, locals noticed one of the homeowners had installed security cameras pointed at the public beach. For his part, Schlieder hopes the community doesn't give up too much. He says other beach towns are watching to see what their rights are.
So the vast majority of easy access to water is privately owned. And that's why we're fighting really hard to protect, you know, the public accesses that exist now. Because creating new ones is not going to happen.
I'm Taylor Wisner.
And that's our show for today. Stateside is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Rania Cabansag, Chantel Phillips, Lucas Pollock, and Mary Claire Zowell. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be seeing you tomorrow.